welcome to the Trust Your Body Project. Trust Your Body Project is a podcast and social media movement designed to help you heal, eat, and create space for the things that truly matter. I'm your host, Whitney Catalano. I'm an anti-diet, health at every size registered dietitian, helping you stop dieting, make peace with your body, and take the power back from your inner bully. Welcome to episode number 17. On today's episode, I am talking to a Boston-based IBS and FODMAP dietitian, Kate Scarlatta. If you don't know what those terms are, so IBS is irritable bowel syndrome, and FODMAPs is what is it called when... because it's like FODMAP stands for like every letter in it stands for a different word. Oh my gosh. What are those things called? Oh, hey. Okay, I actually learned something. All right, so I looked it up. So it's an acronym. That's the word that I was looking for. But actually, see, this is why we Google things. Actually, there's a difference between acronyms and initialism. So an acronym is when you take something and then every letter, like every letter that stands for a different word, the way that you say it, the acronym is a word in itself. Okay, so it's funny because I went to a website for more explanations, like todayifoundout.com, because I am literally today years old that I found out there's a difference between an acronym and an initialism. So an acronym is like NASA, RAM, so like the memory in your computer, and FODMAPs would also be an acronym because we just say FODMAPs, whereas like LGBTQ would be initialism, and like FBI or CIA, like those are initialisms. So awesome. Yeah. See, learn something new. For a second, I was like, oh no, this is a really dumb moment. I'm going to have to cut this out, but I'm keeping it in. This is a teachable moment. All right. So anyway, I'm talking to Kate Scarlatta. And the reason why I wanted to talk to Kate is because so many people struggle with IBS, struggle with gastrointestinal problems, struggle with like SIBO or other things. And I know that one, because I used to work with a lot of people who struggle with that. And two, there's this period of time where I would go to like a party or something, or like I'd be out with my friends, and an acquaintance would come up to me and be like, oh my God, Whitney, like I was just diagnosed with like SIBO or something. Like, can I tell you about it? And I'd be like, yeah, okay, sure. Sounds good. So yeah, I know a lot of you are struggling, and I think this interview is really, really, really going to help. Because one of the things that I've talked about in earlier episodes, definitely episode number 5 when I went on that whole Twitter rant, is there's a little bit of a disconnect in the RD community between like health at every size, anti-diet dietitians and weight-centric dietitians. And I think the thing that gets confusing, right, is because if you're not specifically working in a health at every size paradigm, meaning that like if you're not going out of your way to educate yourself about health at every size and a weight neutral approach to health, you might misunderstand the anti-diet movement. And it is a misunderstanding. You might misunderstand the anti-diet movement as being against medical nutrition therapy, as being against modifying your diet for a disease or a condition. And that is absolutely not true. I've talked about this 1,000 times. I will continue to talk about it, because you have to do part of respecting your body and intuitive eating, part of respecting your body and like eating in a way that supports your body is honoring the fact that like if you have a condition and you get extremely bloated every time you eat garlic and onions, for example, like you probably shouldn't be eating garlic and onions just for the sake of being, quote, like anti-diet. Like that's not the point. The point is against intentional weight loss, against prescribing intentional weight loss in clients. And so these two things are very different, but people who don't do the research, who don't understand it, and who maybe see the eating disorder recovery community or like the disordered eating recovery community and think that health at every size is only about disordered eating recovery, are confused. And that's honestly, like, you know, at the beginning, Kate kind of goes on this rant about how dietitians need to be like opening up their minds and like not ruling out things like elimination diets when they don't know enough about it. And I completely agree. I think that there's a time and a place for these things. And we need to be screening for eating disorders. So, you know, I'm going to let Kate kind of explain that more. But yeah, I really just wanted to like preface all of this, because this is a huge misconception, and dietitians really need to be like doing their due diligence around first of all, like understanding that Health Every Size is not anti-medical nutrition therapy. It's not like anti-cutting out the foods that you need for your health, but also that like we need to be working together. We need to be like helping each other out and like educating each other. And so that is really what this conversation represents, is me and Kate kind of talking about, you know, where these two things intersect. What happens if you have IBS and you, and this isn't just a conversation for dietitians by any means. This is going to be very helpful for anyone with IBS who's like struggling, if you have a history of disordered eating. And I kind of made sure that the conversation always came back to like, what would you recommend for a client, or what would you recommend for a patient, so that you all are going to get some really, really helpful information out of this. But yeah, it can feel a little bit confusing because there's a lot of, and Kate and I talk about this, there's a lot of GI doctors who, when you get diagnosed with IBS and you go into the doctor will be like, here's FODMAPs, like don't ever eat these things, like bye. And you just leave with this list of foods that you're like not allowed to eat. And that's not at all how this works. And also no restrictive diets should ever be given to someone outright who has a history of disordered eating, because that is like such a potential trigger. There are other ways to go about treating and managing IBS. And so Kate talks about a lot of those ways. And, you know, I think the biggest point of this and like the big picture is that this has to be looked at holistically. So food is never the only answer. And I think that's something that like people oftentimes get really mixed up about, is like, oh, well, food saved my life. Food, you know, is going to be, as long as I cut out these foods, I'll be solved, I'll be fixed. And it's like, no, there are so many other components that we need to think about. Food is never or rarely the only answer, right? Like stress is a huge part of this. And so Kate and I talk about some of those things. I think you're really going to like this interview. I think it's going to help give you some new resources, some new directions to look in. I would definitely recommend checking out some of Kate's books, although she does say that like you really got to be careful with FODMAPs if you have a history of disordered eating, and it's best to work with a professional who understands the intersection of those two things. So yes, that's all I'm going to say about that going into it. I hope you enjoy. There's one point in the interview where I was just, when I was editing it, I was just like busting up because Kate is so funny. So yeah, definitely stay tuned for that. So this podcast is not brought to you by anyone, but it could be. I always do my little singing and no one's ever like commented on it, which probably means that like you want me to stop, but I'm not going to stop. Yeah, it could be. We could have sponsors up in here. And the first day I get a sponsor, I better have all of you in my DMs being like, I'm so proud of you for getting a sponsor, Whitney. You're really out here growing. I'm like, thank you so much. So yeah, I don't know how to do that. I think I have to get more listen soon. So share my podcast with your friends, especially with all your friends who like complain about bloating. Share this episode with them. please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you to Potarni 5698. Y'all's little screen names or like usernames crack me up. So yeah, keep leaving them reviews. I love reading them. If you would like to work with me to heal your disordered relationship with food, to step into your power, to become the like most awesome, baddest, most confident, self-assured version of yourself. And so you can finally stop avoiding all those outings with your friends and with your partner and actually go eat food and relax and not have to think about it. Let me know. WhitneyCatalano.com/book to book a free call. WhitneyCatalano.com/book. Yeah. Yes. Last week, go listen to it. You got a long pitch about my coaching. This week, we're keeping it short and sweet. See, I like to just mix it up, keep you on your toes, you know? But yeah, I am actually filling up my spots right now. So I would definitely recommend getting in on that ASAP. I also have something so excited. This was such a good week. Like, can you tell? I'm kind of freaking out. I'm so happy right now. I'm also full of voices, I think, right now. But yeah, so my coaching spots are filling up. I have exciting things coming. I have so much to tell you, but I can't tell you yet. And I also like secretly love being that like person on the internet who's like, I have exciting things that I can't tell you about. Because I hate when other people do it, but when I get to do it, I'm like, yeah. So that's what's going on with me. You'll find out soon enough. Don't worry. Ah! Oh my God, I'm literally radiating with energy. I need to go like take a lap. And by that, I mean like not take a lap at all. I don't run. So let's get that super clear. I might make running jokes, but you will never ever catch me running unless I am legit running for my life. Or I run at music festivals, I realize, like, not run, but I, like, you know, I'll run from, like, the stage to a food stand and back. I run when I got a deadline, you know what I mean? Like, when I'm about to miss fun, like, I'll run to the bathroom. But that's the extent of my running. And I will run for my life, probably. Actually, I feel like if my life was in danger, I would hide. I wouldn't run because I would be outrun in a hot second. I also will not survive the zombie apocalypse, in case anyone was wondering. So my tactic there would be to coach the zombies. So let me know if you think that's a good tactic. Quick disclaimer that the information in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and is not a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice. All right, let's get into it, shall we? Today's episode, we are talking to Kate Scarlotta, who is a registered dietitian nutritionist in Boston, or right outside of Boston, with 30 years of experience. Kate's expertise is in gastrointestinal disorders and food intolerance, with a particular focus on the application of the low FODMAP diet for functional gut disorders. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Kate.
I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. So I've been really excited to talk to you because, I mean, for starters, what I've noticed is that there's this sort of like misconception around the anti-diet movement and how that extends to medical nutrition therapy. So for, you know, gut health, like you specialize in IBS and in FODMAP diets. And in my opinion, you're not going to want to eat foods. Intuitive eating is not eating foods that make you physically uncomfortable or put you into pain. Like, that's not the point. And so I really wanted to talk to you about that more. So just to start out, tell me a little bit about how you got interested in your work with gut health and IBS and FODMAPs.
Absolutely. So I've been a dietitian for 30 years, and I find it really interesting, to be honest with you, because that I'm teaching elimination diets and educating patients and dietitians about this area, because I've always embraced intuitive eating and have followed Evelyn's work from the beginning. I mean, I've been a dietitian since 1987, so I knew about her work a lot before it got so hot and popular. I really have always embraced food freedom and the notion of a highly restrictive diet, even with like kidney disease and diabetes. I really disliked that kind of education just because I really embrace food freedom messages and that there's no bad or unsafe foods, and I don't like the food culture that it exists today. So that is kind of who and what I am. But what happened was about 24 years ago, when I was pregnant with my son, I developed a strangulated bowel and lost one third of my small intestine. And as you can imagine, as a dietitian or otherwise, the small intestine is where you digest food. And so missing a third of it, I developed quite a few food intolerances that I never experienced before. Mm-hmm. And about 10 years after that surgery, I also developed small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which escalated my food intolerance. It seemed like anything I ate, I felt extraordinarily full. I was losing weight. I was devastated as a dietitian who's small anyway, because I don't absorb food very well. And I just felt like I was melting away and I was scared. And then we learned that I had small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And I learned about the low FODMAP diet subsequently to that, and learned that modifying my diet was a life changer. And so it really, my career, I know this is a long-winded story, but it's just interesting that one, this was not at all what I set out in life as a dietitian. And two, what was really interesting is I started my blog years ago before I knew about the low FODMAP diet, but it was just starting to come infiltrate the US. And what I wanted to do was share, my blog initially was called Well Balanced Food Life Travel, because my husband and I, we run, we love to eat, we love to travel. And I just thought, you know what, this is something I've really worked out well, and I want this messaging to be shared with my followers. But what happened was everyone came to me looking for low FODMAP information. Mm. What do you, I hear you understand the low FODMAP diet. What can you tell me? And so really my audience really were key factors to driving me to come up with solutions for them because they were struggling with food intolerance and really didn't know how to break down the low FODMAP diet. So it's sort of serendipitous, I guess, that here I am and, you know, working with IBS patients and helping them eat a very well-balanced, slightly modified FODMAP diet has been probably the most rewarding work that I could ever imagine would happen in my career. So that's my very long-winded story, but a little bit about me.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. And I find it so interesting that you kind of ended up here accidentally because of your own experiences and just having to figure out how to navigate them. And then people have been sort of lost and were turning to you for help.
Exactly.
So in terms of FODMAP, because I think, or the thing that stands out to me in what you said was this sort of distaste, I guess, for the culture of food restriction. And I imagine what goes into that, some of like the approaches around it or like mindsets around it. How would you explain the approach that you take in terms of teaching about FODMAPs and elimination diets from the perspective of not being too restrictive and not getting to that place that becomes mentally harmful?
Well, I think the important thing too is you really have to personalize the diet for an individual with IBS. IBS itself is a very heterogeneous disorder. Some people have constipation. Some people have diarrhea. Some people have severe debilitating pain that they'd be willing to give up 25% of their remaining life for a treatment that would benefit them. And others are just kind of dealing with low-grade IBS. And I'm not dismissing that, but it's not impacting their everyday single breath. So it really is a very variable diagnosis. So you have to remember that. Is the low FODMAP diet appropriate for everyone with IBS? Absolutely not. When we look at IBS, we have to look at these individuals as having food fear because it makes sense. If food causes pain, you are going to have fear. Now, is that fear pathological in IBS patients or in all IBS patients? Absolutely not. But in some patients, it is. And so we really have to be an astute healthcare provider and really determining where the patient's mindset is. We need to screen for an eating disorder. We need to screen for ARFID. However, I will tell you that none of the tools that we use in eating disorder have been validated in the GI population. And so we have to be cautious. I would be very disappointed if someone said to one of my patients, oh, we can't do the low FODMAP diet because that's going to cause an eating disorder. Because that's not really fair to all the patient. We do need to realize that people with eating disorder, 90% of them experience GI symptoms. And some of these individuals are going to arrive at our doorstep as a dietitian working in practice. So we need to be paying attention. Putting an eating disordered patient on an elimination diet is very high risk and possibly going to trigger their eating disorder. So I think my message to dietitians really is remember your own personal bias. You've experienced an eating disorder and you're working with eating disordered patients, that's your bias. If you solely work with GI patients and not eating disordered patients, that's your bias. So how can you learn about a better understanding of it all so that you can provide the best care to your patient? Because if we just use our own personal experience in healthcare, that's not fair.
Right.
So I think, you know, if you look at IBS patients, they don't, 90% of them don't have eating disorders. Okay. But 90% of eating disorders have gut symptoms. That's a whole different fact, right?
Right.
So we just need to approach this as unbiased as possible so that we can give the patients a personalized approach that is appropriate for them. Really important, because I think that there is divisiveness, there's dichotomy and belief in the dietitian community. And I love the conversation because it has stimulated me to learn more. But I just ask the same for all parties.
Yeah. In terms of from the patient's perspective, because I know a lot of people listening to this
struggle with disordered eating and struggle maybe with fully diagnosed eating disorders and are probably experiencing gut issues. I'm sure I have a portion of my listeners who are experiencing gut issues and maybe don't know how to talk about it or don't know why or how to get help. So what would you recommend for people who have that sort of like cross-section of disordered eating history and gut symptoms?
So my approach in that as a dietitian would be that I would really look at their nutrition, look at their diet, look for balanced meals, look for honoring their hunger, looking for de-stressing, getting away from food rules, internal unconscious food rules, things that are stressing them out. Because obviously, if it's stressing them out emotionally, absolutely, the gut and brain are connected, bi-directional pathway, gut-brain access, they're going to feel stress in their gut. So generally speaking, as a dietitian, I would be working on just general intuitive eating messages so that they are listening to their body, they're eating when they're hungry, they're really respecting their body, they're honoring their health, and they're doing all those magical principles of IE that make sense that will help them with their gut symptoms. And then I would work with a GI psychologist, which is specifically trained in this area, and they can offer a number of different therapies that are non-diet related, including gut-directed hypnotherapy, which is just as effective as the low FODMAP diet, also cognitive behavioral therapy, diaphragmatic breathing. So there's a number of psychological approaches that can really work well. And working with a GI psychologist, they understand the gut and how the symptoms are exacerbated. And certainly, you know, how does diet play a role? If someone's restricting their diet, has a history of ED, the more they restrict, the more stressed they are, the more anxious they will be, and it's not working. The other important thing that patients need to understand, or people with gut symptoms need to understand, is diet is only a part of probably the solution. It's not the full-blown solution. So when my patients come to me, even the worst of the worst, not eating disordered, have really bad IBS symptoms, and we do a low FODMAP elimination diet approach, we're often adding other things. It's not just the diet that's going to help them. So if you put all your eggs in the diet basket, most people are going to be left sad because it's often not just diet, you know, that's going to make a difference. It can be a big factor in helping manage IBS symptoms, but often it's not the only part of the solution.
So when you see a client, for example, who maybe has not debilitating symptoms, but is somewhere in the middle. I'm kind of just like shooting for averages right now. And you see them start to become restrictive with their food to the point of like really intense food fears or food anxieties. How do you navigate that with your clients?
So I can't really say that I've experienced low-grade IBS patients. My practice really tends to be, I would say, and I'm not seeing clients right now, I stopped last fall, but what would happen is we would get plenty of calls that this is my last-ditch effort. I've tried everything and I don't know what to do. Severe, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, 10 for gas, 10 for bloating, 10 for pain, very, very different. I can't say that I've seen someone with mild IBS to really comment specifically to that, but just in theory, okay? If someone came to me with, you know, and said, like a neighbor, this sometimes will happen, a friend, hey, you know, I'm experiencing all this gas and bloating. What do you think about the low FODMAP diet? And I would say, oh, no, it's really, you know, mild IBS, you know, there might be some foods that might be triggering some of your symptoms. What are you experiencing? Well, I'm experiencing like just a lot of gas, like a ton of gas. Well, you know, are you moving your bowels every day? Because if you're constipated, that could be part of the picture. And we kind of talk about just their different symptoms that they could manage first. And then if it's gas, the oligosaccharides are the most common gas producers out of the FODMAP group. So I might say, you know what, why don't you just try reducing some garlic and onion and see how you do. Bear in mind, oligosaccharides, prebiotics, they're good for your gut microbiome. So it's not something I want you to restrict forever, but you might find just having a little less of them. Like I know you start every dinner with garlic. Why don't we not do that for a week and see if that modifies? So it's possible that you could cherry pick out FODMAPs in certain people. I wouldn't talk about FODMAPs in someone ever that I considered to have disordered or high anxiety food fears, because they're going to look it up and start doing it anyway, right? So same with the doctor, right? So I tell GI doctors, please don't mention the low FODMAP diet until the patients see me and I can determine if it's suitable, because the train's left the station and the patient's indebted to the diet, and that does more harm than good.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you bring that up, because I can't even tell you the number of people who I've seen who are put on FODMAP diets by a GI doctor and not given any other information about it, are just like, here you go, here's a handout, goodbye. And then come to me kind of like spiraling, because they don't know, like it's triggered, you know, disordered eating responses, and it's triggered a lot of fear and anxiety. And they've gone down the like 12 hours on the internet rabbit hole and all of these things.
Right.
And so I do find that to be one of the sort of problematic things that's happening in the GI community that we need to be talking about more, is like, all right, we need to be screening for eating disorders first. We need to, you know, have these sort of dietitians like you who are specializing in this to have really strong relationships with GI doctors and to be able to like come in and assess the situation, because like you're saying, it's so individualized.
Absolutely. And I think if we have to remember that our patients are adult learners and they want to understand things. And if you can talk to them about they're undernourished, their gut is a muscle, it's not going to work as appropriately. You know, we see gastroparesis and pelvic floor disorders and constipation a lot in individuals with IBS. And in part, this is due to undernutrition. It's probably also due to some gut microbial alterations that we see in restrictive eating as well. But just poor nutrition is going to impact the motility and function of the gut. Mm. So you keep pulling things away from your diet, you're undernourished. And that is a bigger factor than FODMAPs ever will be. Mm. So I think it's important to speak to a level that is appropriate and that resonates, that patients feel like they're part of the decision-making, that we can come to conclusions together that we both agree upon being good, healthy decisions for them and their body. You know, there's just, it's not black and white. I guess it just simply isn't black and white, and we have to really approach each patient individually. I can't emphasize that enough.
Yeah.
Don't close a door that might need to be partially open, or don't open a door that is going to lead someone down a rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. I love too that you brought up hypnotherapy as a treatment.
Absolutely. It's fabulous. And it's just as effective as the low FODMAP diet. But you know, it comes to this, not everyone wants the same treatment. Mm-hmm. So again, we have to, you know, patient shared decision making is really important. And so gut hypnotherapy is fabulous. A lot of my patients have done it. A lot of my patients have benefited from it. And, you know, it's a great tool, but it's just not all patients are up for that, you know?
Absolutely. And so, because the question that I get all the time, because of course my bias is disordered eating. And so the clients that I tend to see and the people in my Facebook group and things like that. So the number one question I get from them is, how do I go about taking out the foods that I know are causing me pain and that I know are stressing me out or causing me a lot of gas or whatever it is, without falling back into disordered eating, like while practicing intuitive eating?
Right. I think, you know, again, it's really listening to your body, honoring, mm-hmm. you know, going back to that honoring your health. What is the intention of the restriction? Is mm-hmm. it because someone told you onions cause GI distress? Or is it that every time you eat onions, you can really clearly define that symptom? Mm-hmm. You know, so it really does take a little bit of work and honesty in understanding those personal things. If every time, this is my food fear, I have food fear around food safety. Mm-hmm. So if I'm not comfortable in a restaurant, and I mean, you know, I'm pretty comfortable in most restaurants, but you know, in some of those countries that I've traveled in, it's like, I don't feel safe here with that food. I'm not going to eat off the food truck. That's probably a self-protection mode, because foodborne illness can trigger IBS. People with IBS are more likely to get foodborne illness. So mm-hmm. it's a self-protection mode, right? So I don't look at that fear as pathological for me. I look at it as this is a way that, because I've had foodborne illness and I believe it caused my SIBO. So that makes sense. That's a protection mode, right? So my intention is not that I'm trying to avoid the fast food. My intention is that I'm trying to avoid an issue. So I guess it comes down to what is your intention? Is it, do you believe that onions cause you because you've heard that online? Or every time you have onions, you can report that it's problematic for you. You know what I mean? Does that help?
Yeah, I love that. I really like that you specified that the sort of other intention would be that you just heard through the grapevine or heard online or whatever it is that like something's going to make you bloat. Because I think sometimes we don't realize, and I know a lot of probably my listeners would identify this, like we don't realize when we're just taking arbitrary nutrition advice from like random things that we read online, because we've gotten so used to just like accepting these things and being like, oh, I heard, you know, X, Y, and Z is bad for you, and don't question it as much as we need to be questioning it.
Right. You need to question. There's a lot of junk out there. There's a lot of food fear. We are in a terrible food culture right now. It's awful. You know, being a dietitian for 30 years, it's disgusting. Yeah. It horrifies me. I feel sorry for young moms that are trying to feed their babies and all the rules and regulations and expectations. It's like, when is this going to end? It's craziness. So yeah. It is a tough food culture, and there are a lot of fear-based messaging, and we are constantly barraged whether we want to exclude them from our life. You know, one way is really to, you know, we go back to Instagram, but like delete those crazy people accounts, because there's some crazies out there and they're not talking science. And it's, you know, they sound real. They sound really real. Right. And they have a doctor in front of their name and they must know, or they're a functional nutrition coach, but geez, you know, they've got 17 supplements they're selling and these are going to make a difference. Wow. It's life changing for me. And you're struggling and you want to get better. It's a tough place out there to sort through the garbage, really. It is.
It really is. And I think it's so important that you're talking about this right now too, because of course I talk a lot about avoiding messages that really like heavily focus on weight loss and really kind of are selling this sort of fear of gaining weight and this fat phobic message. But I think this is something that I need to be talking about more too, which is just the general sort of food fears that are happening in our culture right now that aren't always like as black and white about weight loss or whatever it is, but they're more so these sort of convoluted messages of like, this is going to like ruin your gut, and like, this is going to cure cancer. And you're like, oh my gosh, neither of those are true. Yeah,
exactly. And you know, when people have a sensitive gut, eating really healthy foods can exacerbate their symptoms. So the messages that we get even from well-intended nutritionists sometimes don't work for people with a sensitive gut. Right. And so it's really confusing. You know, you're like, okay, I can't tell you the number of vegans that arrived on my door, and I'm not anti-vegan diet. I think it's fabulous if that's your lifestyle and your beliefs or whatever if the intention is not weight loss, go for it. But it can cause GI distress in some people. And so the intent to eat healthier, their body is not loving that. And so again, it comes down to that intuitive listening to your body and respecting it and respecting its messages. But with the respecting your body and respecting its messages, just remember food is only one component to that potential message. You could feel bloating or abdominal pain due to stress. A perfect example is I absolutely love, love, love speaking, which is so funny to me because I was the most shy, reserved public speaker in high school, but I love it. But one thing that happens to me when I give a talk is that I swear my gut just stops moving. So when I'm done, I have like, it's gotten better because I think I'm less stressed, but the stress of the talking causes my gut to just stop. I think I always feel just pain, like my belly hurts after I talk. Now that has nothing to do with lunch. You know what I'm saying? It's just the stress of things. So, you know, we always, oh, what did I eat? And people will say this too. I remember when I had my surgery and my stomach would hurt, you know, I was adapting. My intestine was growing and changing after the surgery. I was pregnant. There was a lot of factors that would impact how I was feeling. But my mom, you know, sweetest lady, but what did you eat? What'd you eat? Why did your stomach hurt? What'd you eat? And it's like, you know, my response would always be, it has nothing to do with what I ate, to be honest. I really don't think it is. It's just the physiological reaction of my body to growing a baby and a body that just had surgery. And, you know, it's struggling and there's probably some motility changes, nothing to do with what I eat. So again, you know, even shutting down those messages that we hear from well-meaning husbands, wives, parents, what'd you eat? No, it's not what I ate. It's my body's reaction to a number of different factors. Because if you put all the onus on the food again, you know, you're missing the big picture and it's not just what you ate.
Yeah. I've talked about that before in a YouTube video I did, I guess last year, and how I noticed about my body that when I am emotionally suppressing, if you will, I'm in an emotional situation. I found this out actually by going to a funeral of a family friend, and the bloating and the discomfort in my gut was unbelievable. It was like so painful, and I never have issues with food ever. Like that's just not something that is an issue for me. And it really brought me back to my days of being really heavy in a disorder, like in my disordered eating and having gut issues and thinking that it was like cheese or bread or whatever it was, when in reality, it was a lot of just like emotional suppression.
Right, exactly. So we can't discount the effect of the anxiety, and we can't discount the effect of being on a super restrictive elimination diet exacerbating anxiety. But I will tell you that in clinical practice, really the majority of dietitians find that in the right patient, and I would argue that a lot of patients with IBS are the right patient for low FODMAP, not all, but say 50%, that their food quality of life increases. Their quality of life, anxiety and depression is enhanced. That's been shown in the research. But we see that their food quality of life is better. I would say that the majority of patients that come to my office are eating less than a low FODMAP diet. Mm. So I'm expanding their diet and I'm using the low FODMAP framework to help to successfully reintroduce foods that most likely will not trigger them, because in the science, the low FODMAP diet's been shown to be helpful to reduce symptoms in 50 to 70% of people with IBS. Again, not the right diet for everyone, not the right diet if you have an eating disorder, but in the right hands of the right patient, it can be extremely therapeutic and actually enhance their food quality of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at IBS patients, 84% in research have been shown to perceive food as a trigger to their symptom. And in some of those patients, finally, after years of being told that they have an illness that is all in their head, that it's the psychological disorder, which is fine. I don't want to come across as there's mental illness, psychological illnesses that deserve treatment therapies. But in patients that think food bothers them, they've been told that this is a psychological problem. It's not the food. Mm-hmm. And then we come out with a diet that treats them effectively. How validating for them. This is what they've believed. This is what they've been saying. And everyone just said, just like they're doing an IBD right now, diet doesn't matter. What? Maybe we don't know that diet matters. Maybe we need more research in this area, but don't tell me diet doesn't matter. We don't know, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what they should have been saying to IBS patients. We don't know yet. We haven't figured this out. So, you know, it is validating in some patients that believe there was a dietary component. And now we have science to say, hey, guess what? You were right.
Yeah. I'd love to go back to what you said too at the beginning of that, which was people come into you with such intense food fears that their diet, what they're eating when they first start seeing you, ends up being like more restrictive than what the ending diet is going to look like, because they're kind of scared of everything. I would assume that.
Well, I wouldn't totally assume. These aren't based necessarily on fears which drew them to this. They've been seeing naturopaths. Mm. They've been seeing chiropractics. They've been seeing alternative practitioners, because at the end of the day, our treatment modalities for IBS are fair to poor right now. Mm-hmm. And they're done. You know, in one international study, as I mentioned earlier, earlier, IBS patients were willing to give up 25% of their remaining life. We're talking about debilitating. Mm-hmm. So they're looking. When I had SIBO and no one was helping me, I went to a functional GI doctor. He was a little outside the box. I took supplements that, you know, I didn't really have good science for, but I was desperate. Mm-hmm. So when they're going to these alternative practitioners and they're out there and they're making thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, I've had patients pay $30,000 to integrative practitioners and it's sickening. Mm-hmm. And they're told no gluten, no dairy, no histamine, mm-hmm. no this, no that. So yeah, do they have food fears? They're told to do this. Mm-hmm. They're told by people to do this. People that are in the healthcare spectrum, that this is what they should be doing. And it's disgusting. And they're making money off them. And it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do they have a little bit of food fear? Yeah.
Totally.
IBS patients have food. Yeah. But is that the reason they're doing it? Was it the fear that drew them to do all this? I'm not convinced.
No,
I think
yeah.
a lot of it's the practitioners out there that are telling them that sugar's toxic, that gluten is, you know, causing their brain fog, that, you know, if they take an antibiotic, it's like an atomic bomb for their gut microbiome. They need an antibiotic, but they don't know whether to take it because they've been told that it's an atomic bomb for their gut microbiome. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
it's awful. There's so much fear and they're so prone to these messaging like I was because no one is helping them.
Yeah.
They're yelling off the rooftops, help. And no one is really listening. One study came out this year looking at doctors. Now, I'm not pushing on doctors because they got their own set of problems. Healthcare is tough today. But they allowed patients to talk for 11 seconds before they interrupted them. You can't share your IBS story in 11 seconds. So it's really, you know, these patients are screaming and they're trying to get the help they need. And there's a lot of vultures out there.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really beautiful that, you know, because I think a big misconception is that with something like FODMAP or an elimination diet, when they're not being properly educated on it, there ends up being this sort of misconception that I'm never going to be able to eat anything I like again. I have to cut out, like you said, sugar and gluten and all of these things. And what am I going to eat? And it's just this sort of like feeling so lost, like you're describing of I already have so much pain. This is already so uncomfortable and I can't enjoy food anymore, allegedly. And so
right.
what you're really showing people is that this is individualized. It is about finding out, you know, which things are triggering for your body and which things are going to cause symptoms and which aren't. And being able to like work through that process from a mindset of curiosity.
I think you are getting it right. And, you know, I would add that, you know, of course, we're not talking FODMAPs with people that are at risk for eating disordered or mm-hmm. have, you know, maladaptive eating patterns and extreme food fears. And we really need a good tool to determine that, which we don't have right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a little bit of an art and science in trying to, you know, truly select the right patient, make sure that they're being honest with themselves about food fears. And so they can be honest with us so that we can advise them properly. But in the hands of the right patient, it can be extraordinarily validating. And it's an elimination diet that lasts 2 to 6 weeks, usually 4 in my practice. Mm-hmm. And then we're reintroducing foods in phase 2. And then we're personalizing it. And I tell patients FODMAP intolerance changes over time, constantly try to reintroduce. And to be honest, they become so, and I use the word intuitive all the time because they do. They become so intuitive to what works and what doesn't work for their body, when to scale back and when to go, you know, go for gold. And so it's empowering in the right hands, but it's not for every patient out there. But I'd hate for that door to be shut on a patient just because someone had a belief that an elimination diet is terrible and is going to cause an eating disorder. I think we need to use it responsibly and, you know, you can cherry pick out FODMAPs. There's ways around doing different things for different patients. But again, if eating disorder or there's, and of course, you know, we have to be in tune to that in a GI practice always. And there's nutrition therapies even in eating disorders, right? So even if it's just regular discrete meal times and adding foods that they fear gently back onto their plate so that they gain confidence that that wasn't the food trigger that they thought it was. How many patients have I added gluten back to? A million.
Yeah.
So, you know, my goal as a GI dietitian, and I've said this on my Instagram feed, is not to restrict my patients' diet further. It's generally to add more food back to a more liberalized diet so that they can have good symptom management while enjoying as many foods as possible.
I love that. I think that's so important and it's going to be really probably a big relief for a lot of people to hear. So, I'm curious about your perspective on Whole30.
Oh, yeah, I don't like any of those. I'm not, yeah, nope. No, nothing that puts food as a moral issue, safe, unsafe, stupid rules, no.
That's a big question that I get because it is sort of being advertised in circles about for like elimination and gut health and things like that. And people get very confused by that because, you know, they try it out for themselves because they don't have doctors listening to them or they don't have, you know, providers that are really able to like understand and take them through this process. And so they're trying whatever they can, which right. So much like empathy for that. But yeah, I was just, it came to mind as you were talking about elimination diet, because I have had people ask me about that. Like, what do you think about it for gut health? And I'm like, I just don't love anything that was not written by a dietitian.
Yeah, well, you know, it comes down to this. Is it evidence-based?
Right. Exactly.
No, it isn't. Is the low FODMAP diet evidence-based? Yeah, it is. So it comes to, is it medical nutrition therapy that's been researched? There's 7 randomized control trials, at least on the low FODMAP diet. There's a number of other small studies looking at it. Is it appropriate for everyone? Again, no. Is it appropriate for some people? Yes. Can it be life-changing for them? Is it the most rewarding work that I've ever done? And I can't believe I'm in this space. Yes, absolutely. I can't stand the Whole30. I don't like any of those stupid programs. Now, are there some good messages in Whole30 about eating more plants and fiber and food in its natural state? Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, we should all be eating more fiber. Fiber's good for our gut. We're not eating enough of it. And there's lots of different kinds of fiber. And should we be eating more plants? Yeah. As a general rule, none of us are getting enough fruits and vegetables. We probably should try. But again, it goes back to intuitive eating. Honor your health, gentle nutrition, respect your body. Eating a bunch of Twinkies, is that respecting your body? I don't know. I mean, eating a Twinkie every day because it's your favorite thing and it brings you joy and happiness, I would argue, yeah, it is. Eating a box of Twinkies for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I might argue, I don't know that you're respecting your body at that point. You know what I'm saying? Like, Do I eat chocolate every day? Yeah. I buy Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Yeah. Do I have lactose intolerance? Yeah. Do I keep it to a smaller portion? Yeah.
Yeah.
It all works. Do I love it with a big, you know, chocolate chip cookie dough with walnuts? Yeah. Do I feel bad about it? Never. So yeah, I just, you know, is Ben and Jerry's cookie dough ice cream low FODMAP? No. Do I follow a modified low FODMAP diet? I do.
Yeah.
You know, it's just gray. We got to move away from black and white.
Absolutely.
It's gray.
Yes.
For all messages. And, you know, for all messages for all dietitians, it's gray.
That's so funny. For whatever reason, the thing that I get a lot, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, but the thing that I get a lot from, you know, trolls on Instagram basically is like, oh, so you're just telling people to eat a packet of Oreos every single day, like a whole pack, and that's good for them. And I'm just like, first of all, I guarantee you'd get sick of Oreos in like 2 days. And second of all, like, why are we harping so much on, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with having these things that you enjoy. And I know people with like pretty severe lactose intolerance, my friends and things, pretty severe lactose intolerance, who sometimes they're like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to have some ice cream. I'm going to pay for it tomorrow. But like, tonight we're going to do that and we're going to just have a little bit, but like, that's okay. And sometimes right. you've got to make those like decisions for yourself based on what's going on in your life and like weigh the pros and cons and decide what makes sense for you. And like you said, be honest about it, like be honest about where this is all coming from and sort of, you know, not be so quick to give up the enjoyment in life, but you got to weigh it. It's not black and white. It's nuanced.
Right. And it's got to be it's got to fit. You know, the food guilt needs to go mm-hmm. and you just need to find what brings you joy. And, you know, I always say my two messages that since I've been a dietitian for 30 years, eat foods you love. Mm-hmm. Don't allow yourself to get over hungry. And, mm-hmm. You know, like those, if you can manage eat foods you love and manage your hunger, girl, you're good. Mm-hmm. You know, that is going to control half your life. And so I have 3 kids. They're all grown. We had candy in the house every single day and mm-hmm. it was on the counter. It was just there. Like it just always was. And no one really even noticed it. If they wanted it, they had it. If they didn't want it, they didn't have it. And it was so funny because every time we'd have a, you know, friend over for a play date, I mean, the candy bowl, I would forget about it and they would just eat the whole thing down to the bone. You know, the friend, you know, I think it does go back to those. If you make it forbidden, you want it. And if you allow all foods, they don't become the forbidden fruit. And, you know, my kids, as kids, my husband and I love ice cream, as you know now. And, we would say, you know, who wants to get an ice cream? And half the time they'd be like, yeah, nah. You know, it just wasn't like a big deal. And I just feel like food shouldn't be such a big deal.
Yeah, I could not agree more. So switching gears a little bit to close us out, because this is one of my favorite things. And I actually just went on a Twitter rant the other day about this. What are your thoughts on squatty potties?
Oh, fabulous.
The best.
Yes, it's so awesome. Yes, we have done giveaways with squatty potty. I am all over them. Constipation is a major problem. Mm-hmm. If you are not evacuating all the poop in your colon, you're going to feel bloated. Mm-hmm. End of story. So a squatty potty can really help eliminate. It makes, you know, what I tell my patients, it takes your like anal canal or rectum from like the shape of a C to a straight line. It really allows proper elimination. So yes, yes, yes to squatty potty. Total big fan. Most of my patients have them. My son-in-law has a couple, you know, he's stolen them from me.
Yeah.
So all good. Yeah. We're into the squatty potty for sure.
Yeah. I read that book. Oh, I forget who it's by now, but I think it's just called Gut. And it came out a couple of years ago and I read it and it has those really cute diagrams in it of how the squatty potty works with the colon and how it just like elongates it when your knees are up high enough. I had already had a squatty potty at that point. And like I said, I don't have IBS. I don't have any sort of symptomatic issues really, except for when I'm emotionally suppressed. When people tell me, you know, I get this response a lot of like, oh, I don't need that. And it's like, we all need it.
Like, yeah, it's normal for us to squat. That's the way you know, we were designed. No, absolutely. Especially if your audience is, if there's a number of individuals that have had eating disorders, pelvic floor dysfunction is a common problem in eating disordered individuals. And so the muscles are just not working as well. And this just will help with elimination patterns and that bloating that feels triggering for people with eating disorders. So I think that it is a really, but it's a great tool for most Americans and really kind of help with elimination patterns. So yeah, I'm a huge squatty potty fan. Absolutely. Awesome. Yes. Yes. The other thing just as we're on pooping a little bit, my favorite topic before we wrap up. Another thing is pelvic floor physical therapy. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but some people really benefit from physical therapy for their butt. And I would say it's probably one of my number one, the low FODMAP diet, treating small intestinal bacterial overgrowth in some of these severe cases, and then pelvic floor physical therapy has kind of been my trifecta. Mm. And even though I don't do full-blown elimination diets in everyone, I may use that in the back unconsciously when I'm cherry picking out some of their foods and substituting in to see if we can get better symptom management in patients. The pelvic floor physical therapy for people that suffer with constipation can be quite helpful. So just something to look into as well, your audience. The condition is called dysnergic defecation that benefits. And again, you can look dysnergic defecation up if you choose to, if you really suffer with constipation.
That is, I'm sure, going to be so helpful. Like you said before, it's not just about the food. It's you've got the food component, you've got this physical therapy, and you had mentioned the hypnotherapy and getting a GI psychologist, which I didn't even realize. I mean, I knew there were GI psychologists, but I don't know how common they are.
Yeah, you know what? They're very much emerging right now. So the Rome Foundation has a GI psychologist listing that is currently building. So you can just query Rome Foundation GI psychologist, and you can find a GI psychologist in your area. Now, are they in every town? No. But some of the GI psychologists will consult via Skype or via telehealth, which has been shown in the research to be just as effective. So if there's not one in your area, yeah, definitely. I have a number of posts on my, and I can send them to you if you want, but I have a number of posts on different GI psychology interventions that can be helpful. Or you can just look up GI psychologist Kate Scarlatta. And then lastly, one of the things that I really, and I hope you don't mind the shameless plug, but one of my biggest probably babies, something that I'm really passionate about, is my I Believe in Your Story campaign. And this is an IBS and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth campaign that really raises awareness of these conditions and raises funding for research, because there's about 11 cents allocated for IBS research from NIH per patient. 11 cents. Hmm. It's pathetic. And so my efforts through the I Believe in Your Story campaign, which is you can find on my website, katescarlotta.com, just tells you a little bit about ways you can get involved, ways you can donate to research, ways you could use the hashtag I Believe in Your Story. The month of April is IBS Awareness Month. Get loud. We need a lot of voices out there. We want patients or people that have IBS and SIBO to feel supported. So that's something that is, you know, volunteer activity that is really probably the most important work that I've done as a dietitian.
That's amazing. Really quickly before we end, I'm curious, why do you think that so little money is going towards this kind of research?
IBS has always been kind of the stepchild. You know, patients have never really been heard or listened to. It's always been kind of talked about as it's in your head, not a real diagnosis. If you look back at the history, it's really terrible. And, you know, it just, maybe because people will live with it, it won't kill you. You know, we tend to put a lot of money towards things that big money pharmacological agents are used. So if it's an expensive drug, then big pharma will support it. And we're very pharma sponsored in research in the US. NIH is, you know, not pharma sponsored necessarily. It's government funded research. But I just think that because it's not a scary diagnosis from the fact that it doesn't have a high mortality risk, it just gets under the radar.
Right. And that's where this whole conversation about, you know, what is quality of life worth in research comes in, because it's like, you know, I feel like quality of life is such a conversation that's happening among eating disorder and disordered eating dietitians, among, you know, just general non-diet intuitive eating dietitians, among like IBS dietitians, because there's sort of this lack of focus around quality of life in so many different realms that we need to be talking about more, because just because something isn't deadly doesn't make it any less important.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I think they did a research study looking at IBS and quality of life, and IBS came below having end-stage renal disease. Mm. So people on dialysis have a better quality of life than IBS patients. That's why we need to get loud and we need to raise money. And these patients have been suffering in silence, because talking about poop and diarrhea and constipation isn't sexy. Mm-hmm. And we need to change that. We need to give them this virtual hug by sharing the hashtag, by yelling loud, by doing whatever people can do to change this story for people that have been suffering far too long. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I will link to everything that you mentioned in the show notes. So for people, and in the associated blog post with this, I will link to everything. So for those of you who are wondering, you know, needing a list of what was mentioned here. And then tell me, you know, I know you've got the campaign going on and all of that, but tell me what else you've got going on that you want to plug.
Well, I have, you know, I love you to follow me on Instagram, which is just my name, Kate Scarlotta. I'm on Twitter, which is KateScarlotta_RD. If you're a practitioner looking for low FODMAP resources, I do have a number of resources on my website for free to be utilized with patients. If you're a patient, don't look at those handouts. See a dietitian and get the proper guidance that you need. The low FODMAP diet is best in the hands of an expert, not to be done on your own. I do have a book that I co-authored called The Low FODMAP Diet Step by Step for people that are working with a dietitian and found that the diet's appropriate. It could be a good resource for you. And then, you know, that's enough for today. Yeah. And just follow along with my I Believe in Your Story campaign. Like I said, it's a volunteer activity, but I think could really mean a lot to individuals out there suffering with IBS. So thanks.
Yeah. I definitely agree. I know so many people come to me like just so lost, and that's not where my training is. So I always point them in a different direction, but it's like, you know, there's this sort of desperation that you were explaining of like, no one is giving me any answers. So,
right.
Thank you so much, Kate. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
If you are loving the Trust Your Body Project podcast and are ready to dive headfirst into your healing transformation, head on over to whitneycatalano.com/food-freedom to learn more about working with me. whitneycatalano.com/food-freedom.